Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
The Athletic.
Hello, thanks so much for tuning in and joining us on this week's Zonal Marking podcast, which is brought to you by The Athletic. It's also brought to you by the usual gang, myself, Ali Maxwell, joined by Michael Cox, who is The Athletic's tactics writer, and Tom Warville, who covers all things data and data analysis around the beautiful game. We're going to get straight into our topic this week because, firstly, there's quite a lot to discuss, Michael, and also we want to do these three teams that we're talking about justice because we may not be talking about them for much longer.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about the relegated trio, who I think looking at the league table is pretty much done. We want to talk about a wide variety of teams, but maybe best to do them now rather than waiting a couple of weeks when we're going to be talking about the Champions League final or European Championships or something like that. So yeah, we're talking about the sides that are destined to go down.
So this is, you have to say, something of a pre-death post-mortem, certainly for Fulham and for West Bromwich Albion, who haven't been mathematically relegated yet. But in the instance of any doubt from the listener, here is the relegation situation, which Michael has decided is done, that the show's over. All teams that I'll mention have four games still to play. Burnley and Newcastle are on 36. Then there's a dotted line. Then there's a 9-point gap to Fulham, 1 point below them, West Brom, therefore 10 points from safety, and Sheffield Wednesday down on 17 points, 19 points from safety, and their relegation having been confirmed a fair few weeks ago. We're also going to consider, after we've given this post-mortem, whether these teams may do what their predecessors, Norwich and Watford, have done this season and bounce straight back. Of course, in the Championship, Norwich have been crowned champions, Watford promoted in second place, and Bournemouth, the third relegated side from last season, are heading into the playoffs with every chance. They'll probably be favourites for them alongside Brentford. So, Tom Warville, if you wouldn't mind, for those who have taken their eye off those three teams relegated last season, just talk me through the general themes of Norwich, Watford and Bournemouth seasons and how they approached bouncing back, which has to be the goal for the three that we'll talk about today.
Yeah, with Norwich, they've largely trusted the process, I guess, which is something that has become synonymous with the club, with Daniel Farker and with Stuart Webber at the helm as well. You know, same manager, a couple of more reliable starters this year in Grant Hanley and Oliver Skipp's come in from loan from Spurs and done a really solid job in midfield as well. And then we've seen kind of Max Aarons, Tim Krul, Timo Pukki all kind of keep the roles they played last year. You know, they've played a lot of minutes, they've contributed a lot on the field and in Aarons and Pukki's case a lot going forwards. And Norwich have got more out of Emi Buendia as well. He's kind of had this free reign in midfield when he of kind of where he picks the ball and seemingly what he chooses to do with it as well, and he's having a fantastic individual campaign.
Well, which is, many people are wondering whether it might be the best individual campaign that we've seen since Adel Tarab's famous 2011-12 season, where he racked up 40 goal contributions. I think it was 21 goals and 19 assists in promotion under Neil Warnock with QPR. That is how good Buendia's season has been. I think he's currently on perhaps 14 goals, 16 assists. So the question marks from last season in the Premier League were, he doesn't have enough of a goal threat and he's a bit too hot-headed. And if I'm honest, one of them has definitely been answered with those goals, but he has also been sent off twice this season.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's it's a conversation for another time, but yeah, interesting that we've got both him and Ivan Toney who've had, you know, stellar individual campaigns. I think Tony's now combined for 40 goals and assists in total for this season. So that's Norwich. Watford, we saw a side who weren't great under Ivic, I think. I think maybe, you know, underlying numbers looked okay, but they were just very stale, very slow, very stagnant on the ball. And that's completely changed with Sissoko coming in. Ismaïla Sarr was originally playing centre forward under Ivic, and he's moved back out to his more familiar wide right position. And I think we spoke about him before, like not having a great campaign and thinking that you'd expect his numbers to bounce up a lot more at the Championship. That hadn't happened. Moved back to the right, and he's been a tear recently. I think he's scored 10 goals out wide this season, and I mean, he's having the best goal scoring season of his young career so far, so that he's been really good for Watford. And then lastly, you know, Bournemouth vastly improved in recent weeks when you look at their kind of rolling XG, and they didn't really change the squad a ton after relegation in terms of bringing players in. Now, Bournemouth lost Callum Wilson, they lost Ryan Fraser, they lost Nathan Ake, Josh King, Harry Wilson, all gone, and the only player who they've kind of bought in who's new, who's contributed a lot of minutes, is Cameron Carter-Vickers, who's at the back. So a lot of kind of organic internal transfers that have kind of powered Bournemouth's campaign this season, getting more out of Danjuma, out of Lloyd Kelly, out of Dom Solanke, who were kind of all youngsters on the fringe in the Premier League last season, but this season they've done far more. And yeah, they look like they're going pretty well at the moment. Although, I mean, a couple of losses last two games out, but I think it was 7 wins on the bounce before that under Woodgate. So yeah, definitely in the mix in the playoffs.
So the blueprint for those three sides, I think you have to say, was helped, and it sounds like a weird word to say, but helped by the coronavirus pandemic and football in COVID last summer specifically. As you say, a very unusually low amount of squad churn when it came to losing key players, losing Premier League talents, essentially. And that certainly, with, you know, each of those cases being unique in their own way, has been the bedrock for largely for those three teams' success in the Championship. So that will be the sort of backdrop for some of our discussion today. But let's talk about those three sides who we think will be relegated. We're pretty confident we'll be relegated. Michael, of course, we did a podcast series, 2 episodes back to back, on how to stay up in the Premier League in your first season following promotion. And then, of course, the difficult second season aspect to it for episode 2. And in our how to stay up in your first season pod, you actually came up with Cox's law of survival, also known as the 25-25-50 law. Just remind me of the details surrounding this and whether or not it rings true this season.
Very pleased that you remember that, Ali. Yeah, so basically it means you can afford to lose 50% of your games if you want to stay up. But you've got to make sure that of the other 50% that you don't lose, you win about half of them. So basically 9 wins and 10 draws, or 10 wins and 9 draws, will keep you up. As things stand, Fulham, who are in 18th place, have lost 50% of their games, 17 from 34. The problem is that they haven't won 25%. They've only won 5 games so far. And they'd have to get that up to 9 wins, really, to have any chance whatsoever of staying up. So yeah, it does seem to be working pretty well this season. As things stand, Burnley and Newcastle, who are 16th and 17th, just above the relegation zone, they've basically nailed the 25-25-50 law in terms of the overall survival, you know, looking at it in terms of the end of the season, because as things stand, they're both on 9 wins and 9 draws. So one more avoidance of a defeat and they'll probably be safe. Actually, Burnley play Fulham on the Monday, so there's a good chance that Burnley will seal their survival and seal Fulham's relegation, obviously on the same night.
Now, Sheffield United, the first team we're going to look at here, they took a different approach, Michael. They read about Cox's law. They decided to trial their own, which is the 15-5-80. That is 80% of their matches ending in defeat, 15% in victory. That's 5 and just the 2 draws. Now, they didn't win, Michael, until match day 18, if you'll forgive the use of that phrase. But they did, in the end, or have done, got well above Derby's record low points total of 11 in a Premier League season on 17 with 4 games to go. But it is just 17 points from 34 games, 0.5 points per game. Do you think they've been as bad as that points tally suggests?
It's funny you mentioned Derby, because I remember a couple of their players saying that they read an article on The Athletic about Derby's season and how bad it was and how the players were, you know, completely disillusioned. And they said, well, it's not like that here, so it's not going to be as bad as Derby's season. So they stuck to that. I mean, the first few games of the season, they were losing consistently quite narrowly. And I thought they were quite unlucky in a couple of those games. So my initial reaction is that they've been slightly unfortunate. But then I looked at the stats and actually they're not very impressive at all. Tom is obviously the stats man and can probably explain more.
Q, Warville.
Yeah, absolutely. I was looking at the kind of per game XG numbers, both for and against. And I mean, going back to sides since 2015-16, they've got the fifth worst XG per game, so they're, you know, barely creating any chances, and the seventh worst XG conceded per game as well. And combined, that's the kind of worst XG difference per game of any team in the last six seasons. So, yeah, the underlying numbers are really not good, and they really match up with performances and with what we'd expect. And I kind of looked at some of the teams around Sheffield United who've had similar numbers or worst expected goal difference numbers in that time, and the list kind of speaks for itself. So you've got Newcastle in 1920, who I think really were only really kept up by some stellar goalkeeping for Martin Dubravka. I think any other season they're you know, likely to go down. Sunderland 16-17 relegated. Palace this season, which again is an interesting one, and I think that you throw into the mix the huge squad rebuild that they're going to require in the summer, and that is a big recipe for potential recipe for disaster if Roy Hodgson is to leave. West Brom the season down, Villa 15-16 down, Huddersfield 18-19 down, Norwich 19-20 down, Hull 16-17 down, Stoke 17-18 down, and Fulham in 18-19 also relegated. So, yeah, the numbers here are very telling that if you play the way that Sheffield United do more often than not, unless you get a bit lucky at the likes of Palace and Newcastle, you're going to get relegated, and they have done.
Now, Michael, in their first season, of course, last year in the Premier League, they were sensational by any measure for a recently promoted side. And a lot of credit was given to Chris Wilder and his assistant Alan Neil, specifically for their tactical setup and fairly specific tactical setup in that 3-5-2. We did a whole podcast on it last season. It's been referenced to death now. If the system itself was largely given credit for their success, how much can this season's failings be put down to the old classic? They've been found out.
Yeah, to a certain extent. I mean, I've seen that chat a lot, but I think as we've discussed a couple of times on here before, I'm not entirely convinced that it's like the old days where it takes a season to figure out a team. I think the level of opposition scouting now means that it happens within a space of weeks, maybe even on the after one game if you see that system, teams have a plan for it. But maybe there is something about that. Maybe after having played them twice last season, they are less unpredictable. But I think it's, I mean, there's a variety of things involved. I think you don't drop off so much based upon just one thing. I mean, as I say, at the start of the season, I thought they were a little bit unlucky, but there was a game they lost 3-0 against Southampton in December, where they were just completely outplayed. And I thought from that point, there's no chance of them staying up. I remember the changes they made that game were bringing in Billy Sharp and Phil Jagielka. And it just wasn't kind of what you want in terms of refreshing a side that did look a little bit fatigued and maybe a little bit mentally exhausted. I mean, Tom's explained their expected goal difference isn't pretty, particularly in terms of their concessions, but it's worth pointing out they've underperformed their XG in an attacking sense significantly. They've scored 18 goals from 30 XG. That's a collective failing. Rian Brewster, I think £23 million, zero goals. You have to say whether that is the cause or the symptom, that has been an example of really why it hasn't worked for them. I think we also have to mention injuries. I mean, they did beef up their squad a little bit, but when Jack O'Connell out for almost the whole season, they didn't know how to cope without him. I thought actually Ampadu could have been a good replacement, but he didn't really work in that role. Robinson, not particularly good there. Ender Stevens has had a spell as the left side of centre back. And there was one game, I think against Leeds, where they had the two wing backs from last season, Baldock and Stevens, as the outside centre back, and then Jagielka between them. And I just thought, well, that's, yeah, you're playing the same system, but you've actually departed quite a lot in terms of the individuals that made it work. So, yeah, it's been a really difficult season for them, hasn't it? And one last thing, I think of all the sides in the Premier League, maybe the lack of fans has hampered them more than anyone. I think just they had a great spirit and it felt like Bramall Lane was going to be the new difficult place to go. And obviously without fans, that situation is entirely different.
Interesting. Let's talk about any positives we can find. Obviously, Chris Wilder, no longer the manager. His departure pretty strongly linked to just unrest between himself and the owners of the club and the vision of the club moving forward as they drop down into the Championship. So currently Paul Heckingbottom in an interim role, being assisted by a couple of others, Alan Neil himself and Jason Tindall, but so much up in the air in terms of who will take them forward next season in the Championship. Who do you think is their best player this season? Who do you think could feasibly stick around in the Premier League somewhere else?
I think for me, it's probably Chris Basham. Now, he's not exactly a a young player who's going to be around for many years. But I just think if you look at the numbers that he puts up, and we look at kind of numbers from Smarter Scout, his ball progression figures of how well he carries and passes the ball upfield for a centre-back are really, really solid. And Smarter Scout also has some algorithms for measuring the number of opportunities to defend and also the quality of a player's defending and how much they allow teams to kind of progress into their zone or their area. And Basham just rates really highly by that as well. So it just seems that he individually has had a good season when everyone else hasn't really. So I think he's good, and he's someone who definitely will be coming in handy next season. But I think after that, if you look at the squad, I mean, in terms of sell on value slash there for a few more years, I mean, Aaron Ramsdale hasn't been amazing this season, but he was still retained value from the investment from the transfer last year from Bournemouth is another one. And then I think they've got a few good or solid youngsters who they'll be able to play and get more minutes to do that next season. I think Jaden Bogle has looked really good in the few minutes he's had, and there's a reason why some, you know, larger European clubs last season were scouting him. So I think that he's one that will probably pay off in the longer term as well.
I like David McGoldrick a lot. I think his intelligence, his understanding of the system, he varies his position very effectively. And he's got 7 goals this season, which is a big improvement. Last year, he was probably in terms of XG, he was maybe the most inefficient finisher. You sneakily, at the end of your question, added on might stick around in the Premier League. I think that might be beyond McGoldrick, to be fair, because he's 33. And, you know, the sides likely to come up, I think, are they're clubs that think in the long term, don't they? Which is probably explains partly why they probably will be coming back up. Well, certainly 2 of them, maybe 3 of them. So I'm not sure we'll see him again in the Premier League, but I must say I've really enjoyed watching him. And, I've enjoyed watching Sheffield United. It's been obviously a disastrous season for them, but incredibly refreshing how well they did last year. And I'm not sure they're going to bounce back, but I really enjoyed. I mean, I have really, really good memories of that. I was at the first game they played when they were up away at Bournemouth, and the atmosphere amongst the supporters was just incredible, and they got a 1-1 draw, and very fond memories of that campaign.
Very fond memories of last season. The squad depth, particularly, Tom, the chart that you've put together, it's a real mixed bag, this. There are parts where I'm kind of grimacing, but then there's a lot of names that, if they stayed in championship terms anyway, you can talk yourself into areas of the pitch looking and remaining fairly strong. You know, a front two of McBurnie and Brewster. Certainly as someone who follows the championship, if I don't look at Premier League performances, that looks strong to me. And then there's people like Jack O'Connell, who we've mentioned, who suffered such a bad injury and hasn't featured at all this season. And others like Fleck, Lundstrom and Norwood, the central midfield players, who, you know, based on their performances last season, you could certainly see them being an appealing signing for a Premier League side, but maybe have lost a bit of that attraction after drop-off this season. How do you think the squad's shaping up heading into the summer?
Yeah, you're right. It's funny. I probably have to kind of tweet the chart out so people can see it. But if you go by Transfermarkt's kind of categorization of the different positions, this is just very top-heavy. I mean, Sheffield United have 6 strikers, 3 centre mids, 2 defensive mids, and then the back line. There's no like wingers or attacking midfielders in there. But I think having 6 strikers on the books is a lot, but obviously with the way that the market is so depressed right now, you're not probably going to get a lot of money, and especially the ages of some of the strikers and the number of years they have left on their contract, I think you'll struggle to move on any for any real kind of money, really. So that's an interesting area of concern, I guess, and one that Richard Sutcliffe, our Sheffield United writer, has written a piece on not so long ago on, you know, how do you turn 6 into 3, I guess, which is what most teams have, 6, you know, 3 reliable strikers. In midfield, I mean, John Lundstrom, like you said, Ali, had a great term last season and now really hasn't been as good this year. And maybe I wondered if a kind of lower level Premier League side would maybe pick him up. And I could definitely see him at, you know, a Crystal Palace or that calibre of team, just because he seems like a very Palace signing. And then at the back, I think the biggest issue is going to be at the back. I mean, you're going to lose Ethan Ambadou back to Chelsea, Phil Jagielka likely retiring, unlikely to sign a new deal, although that's just speculation on my part. That's on the right-hand side. Kean Bryan on the left, his contract expires this summer. So you're going from 6 centre-backs to just 3, which is a big issue, really. So yeah, I think there's a lot of work to do with this squad to get it in a position to bounce back, even for kind of mid to upper table championship next year. So yeah, you can see the direction that the owners of Sheffield United wanted to go in was to have a director of football, so that they probably foresaw this issue arising, and now it's playing out in real time.
Yeah, interesting point. They've just been so built for the system. I hadn't really considered it in these terms, but you know, that's obviously affected them in terms of tactical flexibility as well. They just haven't been able to deviate from that preferred system. So, yeah, that's a very interesting point.
Yes, and interesting, I guess, to follow their manager or head coach recruitment this summer. I wonder whether they will prioritise someone who has a track record of playing a three-at-the-back system. Of course, as you say, this squad now very much lends itself to that. But plenty of question marks over the summer for Sheffield United, and I wonder if that will impact your answer to the big question. Do you think, Tom, that Sheffield United are likely to bounce straight back up, or at this juncture, does it look like they have a bit too much to sort out?
Yeah, I think a little bit too much to sort out in terms of, you know, personnel. They need a manager. They don't have an identity that the squad can fit into at the moment. So I'd be surprised if they can pull all of that together in one window or two windows ahead of next season.
Michael?
I agree with your sentiments that maybe McBurney and Roost would be a really good championship pairing, but not too much to be positive about other than that.
Okay, let's move on to West Bromwich Albion. I think we have to split this season into pre-Allardyce / January editions and post-Allardyce and January editions. Of course, we did a whole pod on Sam Allardyce when he arrived. And I think I'm right in saying, just to throw back to that, Tom, that West Bromwich Albion's underlying numbers before Big Sam's appointment were absolutely horrendous, right?
Yeah, truly. I mean, again, looking back to that 2015-16 season sample, they were the worst attacking side and the worst defensive side in the Premier League. And I think that was half an XG a game worse off than Sheffield United, who are the worst team we've seen over that period of time. So I think, you know, if Sheffield United are bad, I think, you know, these are truly terrible, probably, you know, shifting the scales for what bad looks like in the Premier League to start with.
Now, let's be clear, Michael. Sam Allardyce walked into a side that had suffered a horrendous start to their league season. They only had 3 points after 9 games. I remember you saying that you thought Allardyce increased their chances of survival. You weren't as bullish to say they will stay up now because of the predicament that they found themselves in. And while they've not achieved survival, do you think that making that change, bringing in Allardyce, is justified with hindsight?
Yeah, I think I said something like 15% to 35% or something, very, very astutely keeping it under 50% there, covering all my bases. But yeah, I mean, there's been a slight improvement, just not enough. And obviously it's come too late as well. I mean, to reiterate what Tom said, there's this kind of feeling that Bilic was slightly harshly sacked because it was after a draw with obviously the imminent champions, Manchester City. But Steve Madeley, our West Brom reporter, did a really good article on basically it was delayed. The sacking was basically just delayed because of COVID bubble reasons. They wouldn't have been able to get a new manager in. So really, in effect, he was sacked after a 5-1 loss to Crystal Palace and 2-1 against Newcastle, which is kind of fair enough. The only game they'd won before that was against Sheffield United. And even in that, they lost the XG 3.4 to 1.7. So they were really struggling. And I think under Allardyce, they gave themselves a fighting chance. They eventually shored things up at the back, although again, that probably took a few weeks longer than we expected. I think maybe the more obvious improvement is going forward, actually. I think they've just looked more dangerous. Diagne's coming up front, obviously a bit of an Allardyce, classic Allardyce centre forward. And now it feels like they've got a variety of tactical options. Hasn't been enough, hasn't been anywhere near enough. But I do think they are in better shape. They're a better side than they were in the first few weeks under Bilic.
It hasn't been anywhere near enough. But Tom, I'm interested to know, looking at the underlying numbers, whether 38 games of this sort of performance level under Allardyce would have had them safe, or at least safer towards safe.
Yeah, since Allardyce has come in, their XG difference per game is about minus 0.44, which ranks roughly 96 out of 120 team kind of season combinations we've seen since 2015-16. So probably enough to be okay over the course of a season to survive. Probably quite unlucky if you're getting relegated with those numbers. So lower mid-table really for Allardyce since he joined West Brom.
And Michael, you spoke quite strongly about the misconceptions about Allardyce's tactics on the special episode we did on Allardyce. How has he approached things tactically here? How has he tried to get West Brom out of this situation?
Well, it's been a mixed bag. I mean, he's sometimes regarded as a long ball manager. I'm not sure that is true. He's been cautious. They've defended deep. They've been direct without being long ball, I'd say. They've looked for Robinson when he's been playing quite quickly over the top. That has been effective in a couple of games, notably against Chelsea. Diagne's come in, but it wasn't really a long ball approach. Certainly they were getting in crosses. I remember that worked very well against Manchester United when he towered over Lindelof to score the opener. But yeah, there have been some more classic Allardyce situations. His first win was 3-2 over Wolves. That was quite telling. There were 5 goals in the game and none of them were from open play. They all came from set pieces. So that was pretty classic Allardyce. But there are probably, what I said in the podcast about him was that over the years he has looked to get in talented players and he has looked to get them the ball in their favourite situations. And I think that's happened with Pereira, who the first few weeks of the Premier League campaign under Bilic was really struggling to influence games. And I think the odd game in recent weeks, obviously it's difficult to be consistent when you're playing in a cautious side, but he's been much more involved and in a couple of games has played really well. So again, I think he's done an all right job, certainly in terms of just getting players in situations they're comfortable in, which he always says is his main thing. I know it sounds a very obvious thing to say, but his approach with his best players is he gets them doing the things that they want to be doing, which you can make an argument is actually the opposite of what a lot of managers do. Every manager now wants their strikers to press and their defenders to play out. And Allardyce is very literally back to basics. And I think, yeah, it's kind of worked.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
And talking of individual players, I mean, Matias Pereira, you mentioned there, undeniably talented. To my eyes, their star man in promotion from the Championship last season. But I also know that there have been some interesting additions in January, not just Diagne, who you mentioned, but Maitland-Niles to an extent, and Yakuslu as well, the midfield player. Who do you think, Tom, has been West Brom's most impressive player this season?
I think it's probably going to be Pereira, just because, I mean, he's been the most creative force on the side. He's chipped in with goals. He's not missed any penalties, which I think is probably important as well, especially for a team like West Brom. And he's doing it all while kind of not really seeing a lot of the ball. I mean, he's only getting 43 touches per 90, which for an attacking mid is not a lot. So I think that I'd be really intrigued to see if he were to move and play on a side where there's more possession, he's probably unshackled a bit more, whether he can actually increase his output even further. So, yeah, I think Pereira for me, definitely.
Any other options, Michael?
No, I think Pereira is the best player. Johnston's done well in goal, but it's one of those where he's had so many shots to save. It's a bit of a Russell Holt situation, if you're happy for me to go back 19 years to another West Brom relegation campaign. And there was a bit of a campaign, oh, Russell Holt should be playing for England this summer at the World Cup. And probably not. But yeah, Yakuslu, he looks a really good player. He's only on loan from Celta Vigo, isn't it? And I can imagine him getting a decent move on the back of this season. Whether he'll stick at West Brom in the Championship, I would be unsure.
Tell me what you've liked about Yakuslu, because it can be tough changing division, changing team in the middle of a season, part of a side that hasn't picked up a lot of points. What's caught your eye?
Just a bit of everything in his game, really. I think he's... he's done well as a bit of a ball-winning midfielder. He's got a bit of, I guess, aggression about him, physical presence about him, but he's also a decent distributor of the ball. I think he's just the kind of older midfielder that a side like West Brom need. You know, they're obviously not a great side. They're not trying to play great football, but they have, since January, had a player who's just basically doing the dirty work and has by and large done it pretty well.
Yeah, looking at Yakuslu's numbers, I mean, he profiles very, very similarly to Declan Rice, which I think is an interesting comp as someone who has a little bit of everything. And if, you know, West Ham are heading towards the Euros, that would be a turn up for the books. They're going to be in Europe next season, and it just feels like Yakuslu is the sort of profile of player you can imagine could work for them in terms of kind of cheap option, someone who can take Rice's minutes so that there's not too much of a burden on him, and you're probably not going to see a massive change in the style of play that they have there, especially when Mark Noble's aging and probably can't do the things that they now require from Rice in midfield. So yeah, I agree with Michael. It'd be interesting to see kind of what happens with Yakuslu, because he's had a pretty decent stint in the Premier League.
A bit more information about all things West Brom, of course, with Steve Madeley covering the club so well on the Athletic site. I mean, just in the last few weeks, there's a piece on Yakuslu and his future, Matias Pereira and his future, and also a piece that went up today on Sam Allardyce and whether he will be leading them in the Championship next season. You can read Steve's writing and Every single writer on The Athletic covers their team with such depth and quality. TheAthletic.com/zonal marking if you're not a subscriber but you'd like to be, and you can start your subscription today if you follow that link. It'll be £3.99 for the first 6 months of your annual subscription. In terms of the squad and how they head into the summer and towards the championship next season, how do you think they're looking, Tom?
I guess starting up top, you've got Callum Robertson and Carlin Grant. Feels like a very serviceable front two for the championship. And I think Diagne's got an option on his loan as well, which, you know, if Big Sam is to stay and likes him, I think it's probably not an awful player to have in the chat with you as well. On the wings, I mean, a lot depends on if Pereira stays on the right. Matt Phillips and Robert Snodgrass, again, probably serviceable for a year in the champ or 2 years if they don't go up. But thinking longer term, there's not much there. Grady Diangana, not amazing in the Premier League this season. And it's funny to think back to the uproar from West Ham and all even the players about his sale to West Brom. And then they've been far, far better without him. And he's not really pulled up any trees at West Brom this season either. And then going back in midfield, Romain Sawyers and Jake Livermore are the only kind of two centre mids who are on West Brom permanently. Maitland-Niles, Yokoshlu, Gallagher going back to their parent clubs. So, you know, definitely need some bodies there. And then centre-back as well. I mean, centre-back, you've got no left centre-backs or naturally left-footed centre-backs there. Sami Ajayi has been okay. Carl Bartley's out of contract. Dara O'Shea down the transfer market as a centre-back. I think he might be a full-back IRL. And then left-backs, there's just none. Kieran Gibbs is off to Inter Miami in the summer. Colin Townsend out of contract. Carl Edwards as well, I think more of a left-mid, but again, out of contract. So a lot of work to do at the back. And then in terms of in goal, it depends if you're West Brom, do you cash in on Sam Johnson now, who is an England international, or at least has been called up to the squad. You know, David Button, probably not a perfect long-term replacement, and Johnson's only on a one-year contract. So again, like Sheffield United, there's a lot to do this summer, and I'm not entirely sure they'll fully be able to yo-yo straight back to the Premier League.
I mean, the good thing is, you know, if there's any manager who doesn't really worry about what foot his centre-back prefers, Sam Allardyce. I mean, as long as you've got a head, you're sorted.
Do you not think he's read Tom Wolver's piece about passing angles for left-footed centre-backs and why that is optimal rather than suboptimal if you have two right-footed centre-backs? Probably not. But, I mean, is Allardyce the sticking point here? You know, if I'm putting you on the spot and asking if you think they'll bounce back up next season, how much is the next question, well, will Sam Allardyce be there?
Well, I mean, Steve Madeley is frame this in quite an interesting way, saying that if Allardyce is still there for next season, it's a good sign, not just because he'll be there, but because he'll only be there if the board have said, look, we've got the intention and we're giving you the budget to get straight back up. So that's why we have club reporters. They make good points like that.
But I mean, for you, that would be obviously seen as a positive thing. You definitely worship. No, you don't worship, but you certainly you have prayed at the altar of Allardyce.
Yeah, thanks for clarifying that. I mean, he's got experience of doing it before, both with Bolton, who he brought up from a lesser point, and West Ham as well, who bounced back first time of asking when he was in charge. So yeah, he does seem to have slightly got some of the fans on board as well, which was a bit of an issue with supposedly having loyalties for Wolves in a former life. But I think he will stay, and I think if he does stay, I'll probably bring him back up.
Interesting. Fulham, to finish us off. Michael, what is the story of Fulham's season? Because I have to say, I have found it very, very hard to have a strong steer on them at various different points of this campaign. It's been like trying to catch an eel with your bare hands, trying to work out Fulham. So give me a hand here. Give me a net.
Yeah, I was going to say. My theory is that they didn't have enough time to prepare for the league. They won promotion in the playoff final on the 4th of August. On the 12th of September, so basically 5 weeks later, they started the Premier League. For obvious reasons, never before has a side had such little time to prepare for the Premier League. And they only got 1 point from their first six games, which was against Sheffield United, as seems to be becoming a theme in this pod. If any bad side got a point, it was against Sheffield United. If you do a league table taking away those first six games and make a league table from the start of November, Fulham are only 1 point off survival. And maybe most interestingly, they're only 1 point off Southampton, who were top of the league at the start of November. So Can you use this as an excuse? I don't know. It's been exceptional circumstances for everyone. But I think it's been a mighty tough year for a playoff winner to stay up. And when you look at the players they brought in after the start of the season, Adrebayo, Lookman, Anderson in particular, I think has been exceptional. And Loftus-Cheek, who's obviously just got Premier League quality. Had they had them for the whole season, and for pre-season as well, you know, it's not just about coming in 2 days before your first game. Had they had their full squad for the duration of the season, I think they would have stayed up. So I just think turning a side who came up from the playoffs into someone who can survive in the Premier League in this year has been very difficult. And Parker's done has come off quite well. His reputation has been strengthened on the basis of this season, even though it's going to end in relegation.
Tom, Michael mentioned their terrible start to the season. I mean, as we record today, they've only picked up 1 point from their last six games as well, having picked up 1 point from their first six. In between those two chunks, there was a weird run of 15 games where Fulham only lost 3 of 15, but they only won 2 and drew 10 of 15. An unusual run for any team to have. And I'm always wanting to know when there's a lengthy run of draws. Are the majority of those draws that could and should have been wins, or are they draws that are being scraped? Do you know what I mean? You know, that feels like a very significant portion of the season to look back on, especially if we're talking about Cox's law of 25-25-50. Talk me through that run of form and why there were so many draws in it.
Yeah, I think any period of time when you have just that volume of draws over a relatively small number of games, I think you've got to point it down to bad luck. I mean, football obviously is a low scoring sport. For there to be that many, though, it just feels odd. And then you look at the numbers, and there are some tight games, but also some tight games where the result of a draw obviously just makes no sense. I think back to the 1-1 against Spurs. I mean, Fulham had 0.9 XG, Spurs had 2.3. So you think on the day they were kind of handily out XGs.
I remember watching that game and thinking Fulham are one of the teams to watch at the moment. They played electrifying stuff at times.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's one of those, if we go on a tangent slightly, is where maybe a couple of big Spurs chances completely changes your whole perspective on Fulham getting into the final third, attacking the box a lot, maybe not shooting, and that obviously not showing up in the box score, but that being something that we value when we watch games a lot. And then alternatively, I mean, they dropped points against Palace. It was 0-0. I think the XG for Fulham was around 1. The XG of Palace was around 0.1. So again, shows games where they maybe should have got more than just a single point, and they've kind of the chance they had haven't really fallen their way, or they haven't, you know, failed to test the keeper, or actually, you know, eventually end up in the back of the net. So I think that it's just a weird run, really. But if you look at their rolling XG chart, I mean, Fulham games this season are just so tight, and I think that it can happen. If you have such low volume of attacking for both sides in a game, you're probably more prone to having draws potentially. So the margins are so thin on that, that's probably why we've had it. But if you look in terms of expected points or expected goal difference, both of those measures have them pinned around 15th in the league this season. So that feels far more apt and far more what you'd expect given what we've seen from Fulham, which at times they've played some, like you're saying, that Spurs game, they've played some really nice stuff. It just hasn't always been borne out on the pitch.
I remember when we did this podcast about how to stay up in your first season, I wanted to know the realities of if you had to focus on being a good defensive team or being a good attacking team, understanding that it's difficult to be both if you've just come up from the Championship, which one was better, which one was more preferable? And I think, as is often the case, the answer was, well, both can have good outcomes. Michael, you don't have to look too far with Fulham to see both the issue and what's been quite impressive. I mean, 8 teams in the league have conceded more goals than them. Defensively, they've been pretty good, but just 25 goals in 34 games. That ain't going to get it done.
Yeah, I mean, a stark contrast from their previous survival effort when their defensive record was absolutely disastrous. They brought in almost an entirely new defence in a way. Like I said, I think Anderson's been a brilliant signing. He's only on loan from Lyon. I think he could play for any club really in the Premier League. Maybe not the top two or three sides, but I think he's really good. He's a really good organiser. They've obviously got a very good goalkeeper as well in Areola. I mean, won Ligue 1 as the regular PSG keeper 3 years ago. He's a World Cup winner. I think he was third choice keeper for France, but still has the medal. And their tactical flexibility as well. That's what I've been impressed by about Parker. I wasn't sure about his level of tactical acumen, but they've been very flexible. I mean, they've shifted between a back four and a back five in an unusual way, often with De Cordova-Reed dropping from right right midfield or right wing back into becoming a wing back. That's worked really well. And yeah, you can't blame the manager for the lack of goals. I was looking at the stats, and across the 98 teams in Europe's major five leagues, there's only one other side that has underperformed their XG by more. And regular listeners of this podcast won't be surprised to know that is Brighton and Hove Albion. But we all know it about Brighton. I mean, it's such a big thing about Brighton in terms of them not scoring enough. And we haven't said it as much about Fulham, and maybe we should have, because they have created the chances, and there's been a lot of games they've lost. As you know, a lot of games where they've drawn, where they probably should have won. And that's why I think Parker's come off quite well from this season.
Anything, Tom, on...
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
The issues in the opposition box, finishing chances.
Yeah, I think what's interesting with Fulham is just how kind of nearly evenly the chance has been spread out and kind of distributed amongst the squad. I mean, you look at Bobby Reid, 4.6 XG, Ademola Lookman, 4.3 XG, Ivan Cavaliero, 4.2 XG, and Mitro's got 4.9 XG, and there's a couple of players after that. And that, to me, says there's not like a focal attacker or someone who's getting the chances on the team. Now, I don't think that you have to have it one way or another, but it's just an interesting quirk that Parker's obviously rotated a lot, but maybe that's at the detriment of having a clinical or main striker in the side. But like Michael says, you know, they've underperformed there actually quite a lot. I think it's only Reid and Lookman who are there or thereabouts, and the rest you've got, I mean, Maja just 2 goals from 3.9 XG and Mitro 2 from 4.9. So another day, another season, those guys are getting bang on, they're getting more than what you expect perhaps, and that's just variance. And I think that, again, it goes to show that they've been unlucky more than bad at times this season.
I still think the Mitro conundrum, which was the same even in promotion last season, is still fascinating to me. You know, he's still got 3 more years on his contract. They spent a lot of money on him. He has been a star for Fulham, there's no doubt about that. And dare I say it, without a couple of quite frustrating small injuries he's picked up this season, maybe they would have had more of a finisher in the box to get them more in line with the amount of chances they've created. And yet, and this is just my personal opinion, watching them at their best this season in that run, they were so fluid, so quick and so skillful going forward, specifically in transition. You could see absolutely how they could hurt teams, you know, more sustainably. And Mitro can't be a part of that system. He, for all his skills, he is very, very slow and very cumbersome and will not contribute to a counter-attacking team. So I just find that really interesting to know whether Parker will think, actually, our best spell this season was a system that I can replicate in the Championship without Mitro, or whether it will be, hold on, we've got a star player, we've locked him down for a few years, he's settled here and happy, let's try and get the best out of him. It's the same question as 12 months ago for me.
I completely agree, and as you were saying that, Ali, peace sprung to mind that Michael did towards the end of last season on, I think it was Mitrovic versus Watkins, and very much outlined that a lot of the stuff that Watkins would do would be the kind of the off-ball running, the, you know, running with the ball, and very much Mitrovic is just, you know, man in box to aim crosses at. And I think that's what Fulham notably did at the start of the season. And it, you know, they weren't creating a lot of chances, they were crying across a lot, they got rid of that strategy, and I think, you know, things turned around afterwards. So yeah, Michael.
I mean, I think he should go. But I think he should go to one of the best teams in the league. I think he would be a great plan B. I mean, he can be, you know, a Giroud figure.
A Llorente.
Or Cavani figure. Yeah, yeah, exactly. You do need players like that. And the problem for, if you're Tottenham trying to get a player who can be a plan B to Harry Kane, the problem is, who do you bring him? Because you don't want to spend 40, 50 million on a really good number nine, who then, you know, you have to convince him to sit on the bench. But if you're saying to a player, look, you've been used to playing in the Championship, or you've used to being in a relegation fight, you can play in the Champions League here. I just think that ticks all the boxes. I think he is really good at what he does. It's just what he does, as you say, is pretty limited and probably not good enough to be a regular.
That's fascinating. And I must say, it's rare that I comment on the character and personality of a player, because I think it's very difficult for us to have a true handle on that. But my understanding of Mitrovic, having followed him in the Championship and now in the Premier League for a good few years, is that I suspect that would be the sort of role in which he'd absolutely thrive. Like, this is a guy who has 41 goals in 64 games for Serbia. I think he's the nation's record ever international goal scorer, consistently steps up in big games for his country. And my feeling is that his personality would absolutely lend himself to that sort of role. And you could see him, like, not accepting it and trying desperately to become the main number nine and thinking that he should be the main number nine, which, you know, might cause a ruckus in the training, in the dressing room. But I think is, as you say, exactly what you like. So there's a zonal marking campaign. Get Mitro to a top six club. I'm all for that.
Mitro to Arsenal. I'm sure him and Lacazette could share the spoils up front, definitely.
Tom, how do you think Fulham's squad looks ahead of next season? I've got you on that previous podcast talking about concern for clubs that live window to window, just in general. That wasn't specific to Fulham, but that does feel quite relevant here, looking at their squad depth and the amount of loanees that they have.
The thing with Fulham, though, I mean, it's happened in 2018-19, it happened this season, is that they go up, they kind of completely shed their Championship skin, and then when they get relegated, they just kind of go back to it, and they go back to the Tim Reams, to the Mitrovic's, to the Joe Bryans, to the Tom Kearney's, and those are all guys who are, I think, apart from Ream, who are still very much under contract for the next couple of seasons. So they were all, I think they were the top five players in terms of minutes played in 1920, and this season they've all played less than half the minutes available. So I think we, for them, there is a lot to do, because like you say, Ali, there's a lot of lone players, and I think that, yeah, four or five of their top players this season are loanees, apart from Tosin. But elsewhere, I mean, again, just Mitchell up front, and now he's going to be joining Arsenal. I think they're going to have to, you know, maybe find someone else, because Josh Madge's been okay.
He's on loan again, as well. On,
yeah, exactly. On loan, and I'm not sure there's an obligation or an option in there at all.
I spoke to Sammy James, who runs the Fulhamish podcast this morning. I asked him about these seven loanees. As you say, four of their most five used players in the Premier League this season are on loan. Seven of 16, if you stretch it out a bit. And as far as Sammy knows, in terms of any obligations to buy and any expectation they will be there next season, it's pretty slim pickings. I think only one of them, there is, I think it's Lamina, there was potentially an obligation to buy, but not if they were relegated. So I think the expectation is that zero of the seven will be playing for Fulham in the Championship next season.
Yeah, I think the Lamina one's interesting, because he's the one that I imagine teams mid-table are sniffing around at. I think he's got a £7 million option at the end of his contract, which is in the final year at Southampton, perhaps. The biggest miss on that is, of course, when you only sign players on loan deals, you can't really capitalise on any of the gains in value of them over the course of the season. And, you know, Anderson is someone that, had you bought, you could probably flip on for a fair amount more. But just quickly going back to the squad, I mean, yeah, you're going to lose the loanees. I think at the back, they're largely set. I mean, Robinson and Brian on the left and Tete and Adoy on the right is good enough for the Championship. Tosin at right centre back is someone that you could probably cash in on. I mean, again, depressed COVID market might struggle, but he was, I mean, for £2 million, something like that, it's a very shrewd signing. And at the back, I mean, Rodak barely kicked a ball or saved a ball in his case this season, and will just slot in as number one again if Ariola isn't extended. So not a ton to do here. It's, you've just got the guys who are still sat in the changing room from last season, now ready to get their starting places back, really.
And Michael, what do you think should be public opinion of Scott Parker as a young manager? Because he's had such an unusual start to his managerial career, stepping in as caretaker in a relegation that was obviously nothing to do with him, winning promotion through the playoffs in a league where they had a huge talent advantage and a financial advantage as well. That was job done, not job very well done, you wouldn't say. And now a relegation in which it feels like he's getting quite a lot of credit.
Yeah, I'm going to borrow an opinion from your sidekick, George Ellick, and say that he's done a better job taking Fulham down than he has taking him up. He was really unconvincing, I thought, last year, their promotion campaign. But yeah, this season he's done a lot of very impressive things, and it seems like his reputation is very good in the game. I know that there were a couple of clubs of a similar stature who changed managers during this season, who were kind of hoping that Fulham might get a bit impatient and get rid of Parker because they were interested in bringing him in. So I think he'll stay there. Clearly, he's got a good relationship with it seems like he's got a good relationship with the squad. Obviously, he used to be a player there. I think the fans are very much behind him. Obviously, haven't been into any games for quite a while. But yeah, I've been impressed by him. And
he's always been very popular.
And I'm pleased with him.
Always been very popular with journalists and writers as well, hasn't he? Famously winning Football Writers Player of the Season for the Premier League in a year where they suffered relegation.
So maybe this is his thing. Maybe he just gets relegated and always looks very good while getting relegated. Maybe there's a theme to that. But no, I'm pleased for him. He seems like a good guy, doesn't he? And I did always like him as a player, I must say. I think he was quite underrated for long spells of his career. So I'm quite pleased for him.
Positive signs for you, Tom? Fulham heading into next season?
Yeah, I think Parker's great, really. Tactically diverse this year and maybe not always got it right, but shows an aptitude to risk, which is probably good. And I mean, the more games you get under your belt, I think we've spoken about on this pod before, the kind of tactical nature of football is you're trying to problem solve, right? And the more problems you face, the better you'll get at solving them. So I think for him, that's a very much a good sign. But yeah, on the softer side, you know, gelled together a very young new set of players in a very short period of time to become the 15th best team in the league. Like, I think that's excellent, really. And the sort of progress you hope for any young English manager. And he's only, like I said, going to improve with more games.
Okay, so out of the three, most likely, Michael, I know you like to put this in percentage terms. You don't like to be definitive with your opinions. Most likely of the three to bounce straight back and be a part of the Premier League in 2022-23?
I'm going to go for West Brom, despite their lack of a left-footed defender, because I rate Allardyce and I think there's a few players around who, you know, got them up and will do so again.
You just think bish, bash, bosh, Sam Allardyce takes him up again, as he's done before.
Yeah, and I wonder, I mean, this is a more general point related to all these sides, but, you know, looking at what's happened, there's, like you said, there's a reason why there's two teams coming back, maybe a third, and the financial problems are going to be the same, aren't they? We've had a whole season without fans. So I just think West Brom have got the infrastructure, and they have got some of the players, and they've probably got the manager. So I would fancy them to come back up. And I hope they do, because I really love the Hawthorns and I wasn't able to go there all year. So I hope to visit again soon.
Tom, who are you picking?
I think it's got to be Fulham. And that's mainly because they have enough of a process in place in the background to be preparing to fill the gaps that are going to open up in the squad once the window opens. I mean, it's been written about quite a lot now. They have this kind of two boxes approach, which takes into account data and scouting, and as long as the two marry up, then, you know, the player can be given the green light. Now, that doesn't always bring in the best players. I think we've seen you know, the likes of I don't want to name names, there was a Fulham season to get hold at one point, but there have been some very I think Syriac is one of my favourite signings, who somehow has made his way through. Celeriac, as we used to call him. Yeah, no, I just think that Fulham have got enough of that in place. The squad's decent. If they keep Parker, then yeah, they've got a shout. But if Parker is to leave and maybe he's poached by Spurs or goes elsewhere, then I think I probably agree with Michael, West Brom, and especially if they keep Allardyce, of you know, they've probably got his magic formula there to get back up again in 22-23.
The two box approach to recruitment for Fulham, but they only focused on one box on the pitch this season. Very, very poor in the attacking box. And that's what's ultimately done for them. Thank you very much, guys, for your time this week. Thanks for talking me through West Bromwich Albion, Fulham and Sheffield United. Again, two of those teams not mathematically relegated, but Michael decided that they certainly will be. So we've said goodbye to them, the pre-death post-mortem. And thankfully, for any of their fans who are listening, there are a number of very good podcasts that cover the Championship. So you won't exactly lose any depth of coverage or quality of it in podcasting form. I can think of a few off the top of my head. Feel free to get in touch if you're not sure what they are. I'm on Twitter at @AliMaxwell_. But from now until the end of the season, we'll be tackling some end of season type content of our own on the Zonal Marking podcast. And we got big plans for Euro 2020 being played in summer 2021 as well. So stick with us. Make sure you're subscribed to this podcast feed for all future episodes. Make sure you're subscribed to The Athletic as well, so you can read every word that Michael Cox and Tom Warville write. theathletic.com/zonalmarking, a good place to go if you want to get signed up today. But make sure you join us again next week on the Zonal Marking podcast.
The Athletic.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.